access number 29039, Mr. Alan Pollock, Reel 13. Now, what else happened? Well, we were talking about the time when you were with 26 Squadron, 121 Wing at Alorn, from June 58 for a while. What else happened there? We've talked about some of the sort of changes that were going on at the time. You know, the new techniques, the green salad, the new low-level role, and a couple of incidents. What else was going on at the time?
Well, very shortly, and I'm, to be quite honest, I can't remember whether it was at Alhorn or Goodislow. I think it might have been the overlap area. I went back quite quickly to be the squadron instrument rating examiner. And I went back to Central Fighter Establishment in UK for that. And it was a relatively short course. I can't believe it was much more than 4 weeks flying. And
now, what is an instrument rating examiner? Sorry,
well, on the average fighter squadron, one had, in those days, PAIs, which later became QWIs, which was a qualified weapons instructor later. PAIs were pilot attack instructors, and most squadrons would have one or two pilot attack instructors, and also definitely one, if not probably two, instrument rating examiners.
Now, what and is an instrument rating examiner?
Yeah. I think the Royal Air Force started the whole idea shortly after the war of trying to turn and upgrade the quality and standards of pilots in their instrument flying. And interestingly, what is not normally known, but instrument flying in itself, the demands for accuracy there do spill over and enhance and help even in something like air firing, because you have to make very small movements, and you know you're actually firing the guns in a fifth of a second is when you're actually getting things right on a flag, you know, and that's if you've done a perfect pattern. And really, all I'm saying is that that instrument side of the Air Force, in terms of getting aircraft down with high standards of both leaders and lead. Of every level in the Air Force on squadrons. And right throughout the Air Force, you have a system of starting unrated, and then perhaps at the tail end of wings or shortly after wings, depending on the aircraft, you can get a white rating. That's the first stage. And then you go up to a green rating when you've got 500 hours or whatever it was. I've forgotten the thing. And then later, master green when you have and you have a higher degree of accuracy required of each stage, really. So white rating, green rating, and master green rating. And then in many ways, it's a natural lead-on to some extent for many people halfway towards the Rissington instructor's course of becoming a qualified flying instructor. Many IREs went on to become QFIs, and then quite a fair proportion of test pilots had already done the QFI course. Not all of them, but a fair proportion, like John Farley and a whole variety of others that went on test flying. So there was a bit of a natural progression there. And one snag about it was it put you slightly, once you'd done the instrument rating examiner course, you tended to get more flying, but some of it was obviously testing and examining and instructing. You got a little more flying on that stage, but you had to work fairly hard to get all your normal type of operational flying as well.
And
we went back to West Raynham, which was Central Fighter Establishment in those days, and I'm pretty certain John Grandy was there, but it might have been Paddy Crisham. I think Paddy Crisham was might have still been there at Central Fighter Establishment at West Raynham, and that's up in Norfolk, as you probably know. And it was on Vampires, so we were on the Hunter 7 hadn't arrived in Germany then. That's the Hunter trainer, and everything was done on the Vampire, and we actually had Vampires on station flights all over where the Hunters were in Germany. And the course really very quickly it got you up to speed in improving your accuracy of general instrument flying, and then, you know, the important business of letdowns and approaches and etc. And also there wasn't just a flying side to it, but there was a kind of what we normally would just loosely refer to as ground school side, of which covered all the instruments that were used. You had to know every aspect of each instrument, and that was on the change. And of course, you know, there were great leaps forward in those, but understanding the basic principles of the six basic instruments which followed from before the war, through the war, till right the tail end of the Hunter era, the Lightning was a different step forward, and the Nat 2 to some extent. But up till then, you had the six master instruments, and understanding everything and anything to do with those and the development was what an instrument rating examiner, that was his main responsibility, and to make certain that everybody had their normal, I can't remember whether it was a 6-monthly check, but every year you had to re-rate and also progressively increase people's capability on the instrument flying front, which was really to try and make certain that you had an all-weather air force. But the beauty of it was if somebody diverted because the weather was bad or something like that, or you ended up at another station, the wing commander flying at that station or the ops people would allow you much more leeway, obviously, if you were a master green rating, to go off in bad weather and to take off almost in any weather as a master green. And so it gave a kind of categorization pattern, and when people diverted in, you know, in terms of the supervision of flying.
So this was about a 6-week course?
I think it was even less than that. I might be wrong, but it certainly wasn't more than 6 weeks, but it was, I think, just over a month from memory. Back at West Raynham, you know, back in UK. And at that time, I was lucky also to fly at a civvy club with somebody who was sadly killed later as an instructor, who I knew, Danny Kay, who was an extremely good skiing instructor. But I went to, I think it was either Little Snoring or Great Snoring. I think it was Little Snoring, but it could have been Great Snoring, the little airfield there. And I flew the Tiger Moth, which was rather good experience. And then I went back to Germany again, and it was back to the normal diet. Still a lot of, we're still doing plenty of practice interceptions, because that was the main role still of all the Hunter squadrons out there.
And I think we covered that side of things.
Then evasive cine was just coming in. I don't know whether I mentioned evasive cine or Chinese quarters. We call them Chinese quarters and evasive cine. That was just coming in.
Evasive cine.
Cine, yeah, C-I-N-E with the, like for cine film. So you used your gun sight camera, and the idea was to simulate a hostile Soviet bomber aircraft at altitude doing their evasive turns. And you went up as a pair and then split, and for probably 20 minutes you alternated 10 minutes each or something like that, from one person stooging at the front, and he would start in I think it was something like a 30 degree turn or a 45 degree bank turn, and he'd press a stopwatch and you'd go through a pattern which from memory lasted almost a minute, that he increased his bank as though up to 60 degrees, and then he'd go round the turn, not pulling too hard, and then he would go down at a certain rate and then gradually pull up the other way at a set rate and a set pattern. And we called that either Chinese quarters or evasive cine. And that was a very useful thing that came in at that time to improve people's tracking, because the pattern was rather like attacking a bomber at altitude, and we also did it as high as we could. I think we did it at 25, 30,000 feet, or maybe even higher. I think we also did it at 40,000 feet. And you were marked on that. And I can just remember, because I just saw it noted in my logbook, that I think mine was 87% on that. And that was almost, I think it was done almost mathematically, the way that was done by the cine section. But you had to roll round the slipstream as you were doing the whole thing, and ideally you were keeping your sight on all the time. But it was a very good tracking, what we called a tracking exercise. In other words, using the gun sight for real, but over an extended time, because obviously in reality you couldn't fire for all that time, but you could do the exercise to improve your tracking, because normally if you could track extremely well like that, then you could use your guns correctly. And it was a combination of that, and often we did evasive cine like that as an integral part of the air firing thing as well. And for the Duncan Trophy, which 26 Squadron had won within 11 months of starting up again, which was quite a feather in their cap, considering, you know, everyone didn't know each other apart from three or four of them who rejoined
the
squadron.
Tell me about the Duncan Trophy. We haven't done that.
The Duncan Trophy really was awarded for the squadron which was in Germany on the day fighter side that had the highest competence in air firing, and also an aspect of it was evasive cine, and the further aspect of it was the whole efficiency of the weapon side. In other words, the 30mm cannon that we were using up at Sylt, it was linked to the number of stoppages you had, because obviously, you know, an element, it was your readiness for war. And as I said, 26, the Springbok Squadron, you know, which was the oldest Dominion Squadron in the Air Force, we were very pleased to get that. And in fact, my sort of co-honorary secretary of 26 Squadron was an armourer who actually helped achieve that. And it was only about 5 years ago I heard that they checked every single round, because they were electrically fired, the Hunter 30mm guns, and he actually checked every single round, because that's what he was told to do by Snowy Lenton, an ex-wartime armourer, and it was rather fine what they did. And that obviously helped us too, because if you had low stoppages and also your air firing was very, very good, you had then a good chance of achieving what we did achieve.
Anything else during this phase? So you've got these mock attacks on bombers, you know, tracking attacks.
Yeah.
You've got the Duncan Trophy. Anything else going on?
Well, low-level strikes were just coming in then. We were switching over, and I see...
We talked a bit about that, switch to that, and this near accident.
Also doing a little more air-to-ground. Air-to-ground was coming in.
Tell me a bit about that.
Because the first, I only did one sortie, I think, in 1957 of air to ground, because it hadn't really come in as much. But as I say, we gradually were going over from the high level role, which is the pure fighter side, down to a mix and of low level strikes and the different formations, because at altitude you flew far wider formations, and at low level you've tended to fly in arrowhead, unless, because you are using your maneuverability far more in terms of turns and that for strikes, and they were obviously, we call them simulated strikes, because obviously the real operational strikes you were doing with full weapons, which tended to come in later, more on the Hunter 9s later. We flew the airmen a lot on number 26 Squadron. I'm sort of off onto a different subject now, but
it's really
partly to do with winning the Duncan Trophy, because I think on 26 I remember flying more of the airmen and it being more organised in an informal way. Virtually anybody on 26 on the airman side, the ground crew side, who wanted to fly could fly, and some of them flew several times, and we had a tremendous thing, as I said, the link with that airman that helped start the 26 Squadron Association many years later. What had triggered him was actually being, as an armourer, being taken up and being allowed to fire on a range. And he remembers vividly firing in the Hunter T7 and being allowed to do an attack himself, or actually do the firing, being talked through it, shown one, and firing the guns. And I mean, that was a marvellous payback so many years later. By the time he'd got a PhD and he'd worked for NASA and what have you, which was rather good. But that integration of the airmen was tremendous help on the morale side. And we had this marvellous chiefy, George Anstey, who I may or not have mentioned. That was A-N-S-T-E-Y. George Anstey was a lovely Scots guy. We had another Scot too, who was also a chiefy, but between them they really ran the squadron, and we were made to feel quite correctly that the aircraft were theirs and that they gave them to us to fly. And he was extremely well organized in terms of, if we had exercises or something like that, the boss would have said what the future program was. And we had a very good boss called Eddie Edmonds, E-D-M-O-N-D-S, who'd actually been an instructor down in Rhodesia during the war, and had a Rhodesian wife, Elizabeth. And the rather fine and rather sad thing was the first night they had us round to their quarter at Ullhorn was exactly, I'll have to work it out now, 45 years later, that he had his service when he died, and so we were at his funeral down in Devon. But it was rather nice because it was exactly the same day, which was American Independence Day, you know, the 4th of July.
Yeah, so there was a good general morale in the squadron then.
Yes, yeah, and that, because I think it's probably reasonably well known that in fact they got the extra squadron number, 26 squadron, but in fact they kept roughly the same amount of aircraft and just divided them out, and we only had 12 aircraft from then. But to get 12 Hunters in those days on one particular day when we flew off to Sylt, was pretty good going, and that's what I can remember that they're achieving, you know, because the other splendid thing with George Anstey on the technical side was his influence, and he just arrived, you know, so he hadn't been there on the station. But what was splendid was that he had sufficiently good relationships and pull elsewhere that he could get enough spare parts and things like that when he wanted them for his aircraft to organise in such a way that we had the aircraft more or less what we wanted when we wanted, which is extremely good. And also the other thing that I'd like to mention, which worked extremely well, was that when people got into trouble on the airman side, almost invariably they'd be asked whether they'd accept that punishment in the normal way after a charge, and they'd normally say yes, you know, because it wouldn't be a court-martial offence or something like that, or to go to a higher authority, and they'd take that. But often it wouldn't even get to a charge, because he would offer them the choice of doing extra work in the hangar, or going forward formally for punishment, and that virtually never happened. So what effectively we did was the blokes that got into trouble were working extra extra time, and that also worked extremely well. And it was just a very fine squadron, you know. It just everything meshed very well. And
now, how long were you with them? You'd gone there, what, in June 58?
Yeah, I was there until, I suppose, September or so, 1959.
Now, anything else happened you want to cover? I'm not trying to...
No, just rushing through very quickly. I mean, I mentioned how marvellous Second TAF was for travel and that, and to indicate that shortly after we started, 26, one of the flight commanders was interested in climbing, and we went off to clamber up the Matterhorn in the summer, and there was skiing I mentioned, and I mentioned the Bad Kolgrup course for winter survival, because that was an important aspect of the escape and evasion. And then the following summer I went down with my motorcycle right the way down to Istanbul through, which in those days was quite a rare thing to do, and the roads, for instance, through Yugoslavia were hopeless. Once got down to Niš, the roads virtually disappeared. I mean, there was a road, but it was just a...
Did you go on your own?
No, I went with a friend on my Vincent. I had the Vincent 1000cc then, and I went down with a guy called Fred Daly, who was also on 26 Squadron. And I remember they were night flying when we left, and we had a slight embarrassment because we literally just got down as far as Gütersloh town itself on our journey, and we had to go back because the rear suspension was bottoming, and we just completely lightened absolutely everything that we could think of, and miraculously, just by saving £20 or something like that, or whatever it was, probably less than that, everything worked all right, and we had very little of the suspension bottoming. And you know, we did have problems. We got arrested in Yugoslavia and taken into, and what was absolutely fascinating then, because you wouldn't think that was still there in Europe, but when we got arrested for taking pictures of a train, believe it or not, going through a station, but in their eyes, in southern Yugoslavia, that was strategic security intelligence. And that, and when we were wheeled down, they were literally people there with these old, not shoes, but the I'm trying to think, describe exactly what it is that you see in all films. They had their feet bound up with cloth, and they were breaking stones there. And the other lovely thing, you know, the other very, very vivid memory was the spittoon in the corner that they'd go over and retch into, and you could actually made a ding. It was like the Goon Show. And then the photographic specialist at the police station, he opened my camera without a word of a lie, my cine camera, and held it up to the light and said, "No, there's nothing here. You know, it's completely unexposed." And off we went, and it was a hoot, really. We weren't supposed to go through Bulgaria, but we then had to go through Bulgaria because, you know, we'd have never got down and back in time. And, of course, in Sofia, we had problems with the... a bit with the bike and also my back, and it was really quite intriguing, you know, when I straightened up my back, and I'd obviously had some problem with that, and there we were. I was helpless on the floor laughing and at the situation we'd got ourselves in, because we'd only had two days to get through Bulgaria, otherwise they'd have reported us. The Air Force had refused us permission because my friend had done all the details on that. And they were going through Bulgaria was fascinating, because all of a sudden, on the main road down to through to Turkey, there was a big tank trap type thing in the middle of the main road, you know, and we hit that at night, and I was so fortunate. We just slowed down, and it was literally a pit across across the main road that went down about literally about 5 feet very rapidly, you know, without any warning at all. But we got down to Istanbul, but the last 800 miles was all on one cylinder. You know, so the fuel was so terrible, we burnt out the valves and had to do it ourselves in Istanbul, and then came back. But it was quite a memorable trip. But it was just to demonstrate that and going away up to northern Norway, and then later the following year I went down to Marrakesh, and it was a marvelous springboard. That's really what I was saying, that Germany was why it was prized. It was very good operational flying. And such a marvellous place to be, to see Europe.
Now, anything else before you left there? Anything else happened? That you
I remember? Think the only other thing was promotion exams were coming up. At some stage, I did those. I think I might have done the B already. I honestly can't remember. Up at Silt, and that's what I associate it with. Oh, there was an interesting incident one night.
Hang on, what about the promotion exams? What happened with them? I mean,
well, promotion exams later, within 5, 10 years, I think within 10 years, they went out, surprisingly. But there used to be a long time before this, there must have been an A exam, which I imagine you took until flying officer. But in my day, to get promoted to flight lieutenant, you had to pass your B exam. And then promotion from, to be eligible for promotion up to squadron leader, you took your C exam. And then beyond the C exam, there was the Q exam, which was really pre-qualifying you, if you passed it, for staff college. And you had to do a fair amount of work, you know, and that was Air Force law and a bit about Air Force history. And quite a lot on the air side, sort of airmanship side, and it was really sort of preparing you, I suppose, for the steps up the ladder of the Air Force career. But all that was really done virtually completely by self-help. You know, you had to get the correct backup. You weren't taught what to do. There was nothing organised by the education people. But on that front, on the education side, I think the airman there said how good it was in Germany. And this bloke that later got his PhD is an interesting example, because he was encouraged to, through the education officer, to make the most of his abilities there. And he glided there, and there was a lovely business where he ended up being able to glide all the way down into the American zone and landed unexpectedly with the United States Air Force away down in southern Germany. But we thought what a splendid thing it was. They were a bit surprised, the Americans, when he landed. But the other great thing I had, just talking about beyond the Duncan Trophy, was we had the fly-off for the representing 2nd Taffet Gunnery. And I went up to Silt then. This is right at the end of my tour. And we were then part... I'm not sure whether this was done on the squadrons or not, but we were going over to two burst attacks on the Hunter, which was a competition. Yeah, you had 50 rounds instead of... Normally we fired 100 and you were marked out of that 100, but... the normal armament practice camp, as I think I might have mentioned, we started at 10,000 and then went up to 20,000. And it was done on an academic basis, so that you had 100 rounds to fire, but you could take 4 or 5 tows going up north and then going south, firing obviously out to the sea, towards the sea each time. So you'd be doing a left-hand attack if you were flying north, or you'd be doing a right-hand attack if you were flying south, on the west side of Silt. But we went over, because that was the competition rules, to two burst attacks. So literally, I don't think you even did a sighter, but normally you went in and did a sighter and academically, so you could pick which attack you were going to fire on. But for the competition, you had to do two burst attacks with only 50 rounds. And you don't, so if you didn't get rid of them, well, that was your hard luck. And the amazing thing was that the scores went up. I mean, completely counterintuitively, you'd think that if you could pick your attacks, but it was partly the pressure and the motivational side that you knew. Well, for starters, you were with the top pilots and second TAF then, and there was obviously a strong competitive element. But I can remember my best two, which I saw there, was 69% and 55%. And those were remarkably good scores if you'd been doing the thing academically. And it was, again, that pressure of having to perform and having to get everything right, because you could never hit the flag unless the pattern was right to start with. It had to be right virtually from the perch through to the attack. And the other lovely thing was I was able to get checked out on the Meteor up at Sylt, flew the T7 and then the F8, the final fighter version of the Meteor, which was helpful to me later. And also to get checked out on the Swift before I left.